Although we're constantly told that a balanced diet is important for good health, there are often conflicting reports in the media about which foods are good and which are bad. Some, like walnuts and blueberries, have even been called superfoods. For this week's Please Explain, we're looking at what makes a food a superfood. And joining us is Dr. Drew Ramsey, an assistant co-author of the an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Columbia University. He is the co-author of a book called The Happiness Diet, published by Rodale, and the co-author of a forthcoming book called 50 Shades of Kale, which is not as kinky as it sounds. That'll be published by Harper Wave in June. Of course, we are inviting you, our listeners, to join the conversation. If you have a question, you can call us at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org. Also, reach us on our Facebook page or on Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you, Leonard.
So what are so-called superfoods?
Superfoods are foods that we generally think of as having great health benefits. They're better than other foods for two reasons, really. One, they have a higher concentration of nutrients in relationship to the number of calories that they give you. So you're going to get a lot of nutrients for not a lot of calories. The second thing we think about with superfoods usually are what are called phytonutrients. And phytonutrients are plant-based nutrients. They're molecules that are only found in plants. Well, a lot of times when people talk about antioxidants, they're talking about a set of compounds called flavonoids. And these are very interesting molecules in terms of how our body interacts with them. They're really more than antioxidants. They actually change the way your DNA is expressed and lead to lower states of inflammation.
And they're different from antioxidants?
Well, they're antioxidants, but that's just one of their functions. I mean, I think the really interesting function, what excites me about them as molecules, is they actually change the way that your DNA gets expressed.
Now, why would something that is against oxidants be good for us?
Well, so let's talk a little
bit. I mean, we live off of oxygen.
We live off of oxygen, exactly. And part of living off of oxygen is when we burn fuel, and we burn fuels like sugars and fats, end up with free radicals. Free radicals are like molecules. Molecules kind of want to hold hands. They want to bond to other molecules. And a free radical is like a molecule that is not holding a hand right now. It's reaching out to other molecules. It's got an extra electron in its outer valence is what it's called. And that's dangerous because it's going to reach out and grab onto all kinds of different molecules. And so we know that free radicals, which come from oxidizing sugars, tend to damage cellular structures, damage cell membranes, and even damage DNA. So that's why we want to have antioxidants in our diet.
So it's not so much a matter of them preventing cancer as not we're not eating foods that could lead to cell damage.
That's right. Another point is that you make a lot of antioxidants. Your body is naturally programmed to you code for proteins like glutathione or superoxide dismutase. These are very, very powerful antioxidants in every cell that you make.
Well, we keep on hearing about things that are going to be good for us, and then they disappear. In the 90s, oat bran was called a miracle food. More recently, things like kombucha tea, pomegranate juice have been touted. Can focusing on one single food really benefit your health?
I don't think so. And I think this is where people get really frustrated, that oftentimes the notion of a superfood is really used as a marketing tactic. There's not, for example, evidence, good clinical evidence, that something like pomegranate juice is the key to your health.
But it's not bad to drink it sometimes.
Well, I'm not a big fan of juice. And I think the pomegranate juice, they've gotten actually in quite a bit of trouble for their advertising campaigns, both with the FDA and the FTC, because they're misleading. And people who, for example, have heart disease look at these advertisements and think the way to fight heart disease is by drinking pomegranate juice, and that's not true.
So pomegranates are not among the superfoods?
Well, there's a difference there. Pomegranates are a superfood. Pomegranate juice, I would say that's less of a superfood because when you eat a pomegranate, you're getting all kinds of things. For example, you're eating the seeds, which have lots of elegatannins, which are great and powerful antioxidants. You're getting lots of fiber. You're eating it slowly. And think about the amount of number of pomegranates that you eat. You eat one, it takes you a while to eat a pomegranate. It's a very passionate and delicious food, right? Mm-hmm. But to drink a can of pomegranate juice, you're drinking several pomegranates. That's not normal.
And you're not having to separate all that white stuff from the seeds.
Yeah, and that white stuff has some nutrients in it.
I never eat that.
Yeah, well, you should eat that.
Dr. Drew Ramsey is my guest. He's an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Columbia University, co-author of The Happiness Diet. You may remember he visited our show a little while back to talk about that. It's published by Rodale. And later we'll be talking about kale because he is the author, co-author anyway, of a forthcoming book called 50 Shades of Kale, published by Harper Wave in a couple of months. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's talk about fats for a moment. Omega-3 fatty acids are supposedly beneficial, but the word fat usually sounds like something dangerous.
Yeah, that's a big problem that we've had really over the last 30 or 40 years in health, that fat has gotten a bad name. That started with some relatively bad science in the 1950s. Fat is essential. All of your cells are made of fat. Your brain is 60% fat, and fat is very important in the human
body. I've
been
called a fathead, so well, I'm not surprised.
So those omega-3 fats are one of the major fats in your brain, and they're very special. They're very cool fats. The longest DHA is about 22 carbons long. It's a very long fat. It has lots of interesting functions, anti-inflammatory functions. It really improves. The function of your brain cells depends on omega-3 fats.
But there are other omega numbers.
There are omega-6 fats, which are...
Are they good?
They're essential. And what that means is you have to eat them. So you have to have omega-6s in your diet, and you have to have omega-3s in your diet for optimal health. Those two fats, there's a lot of confusion about them. They're both essential. Omega-6 fats are more pro-inflammatory. So when you have an injury, when your cells need to respond to something, a toxin, a virus, it's good to have those around, but they're out of balance in our modern diets. And that's the real problem, that we eat too many omega-6s and we don't eat enough omega-3s.
And fish is omega-3 mostly?
Yes. So the main
source. So when my mother used to say that fish was brain food, she was actually telling me something that was true?
Yes. Your mother was.
Because she really lied to me about the carrots helping my eyesight.
Well, I don't think that's true. I think the carrots are good for your eyesight. I think that your mother was exactly right. Fish is very, very good for your brain, good for your health in general, because of those omega-3 fats, because of all the other things we find in fish, like vitamin B12 and iodine, a good complete protein. Everyone is in agreement that fish is good for you.
Now, what about the omegas that we find in eggs in some cases? They tout that they contain omega-3s.
Yeah, so this is, I think, an example of food marketing, that anything that's raised naturally, for example, a chicken that is out foraging in the field, what we call a pasture-raised chicken, is going to be eating lots of different insects and grubs and getting more omega-3s in their eggs. What chicken producers or egg producers have done is now they start feeding chickens flaxseed. That boosts the omega-3 content. You get a few hundred milligrams in an egg. It's about as many omega-3s as you also get in grass-fed beef. When we're talking about fish, a good fatty fish like salmon or mackerel, you're talking thousands, usually 3,000 to 4,000 milligrams of omega-3s per serving.
Now, I've often been told that nuts and avocados are fattening, that avocados have high cholesterol, could raise my cholesterol, but you include them in the superfoods.
Yeah, that's not accurate. I would say that, for example, an avocado, this is where there's a lot of confusion, that let's clear it up right now. Eating fat doesn't make you fat. What's most clearly linked to people getting obese and diabetes is eating sugar and eating refined carbohydrates, eating a lot of baked goods. And so something like an avocado, I love telling patients to eat avocados because they're creamy and they're delicious and they're filling and they're very good for you. And the main fat in there is a monounsaturated fat that, again, it's on everyone's list as a good, healthy fat.
Mark Bittman has been writing for years about the evils of sugar, and he claimed in a recent op-ed piece in the New York Times that it's sugar, not obesity, that is the cause of the rise of diabetes in this country.
Yeah, so he's talking about a recent study out by Dr. Lustig. And Dr. Lustig is a physician who focuses on the pediatric population and obesity and has really been at the forefront of criticizing sugar and looking at sugar. And again, because we've been so focused on fat and pushing for people towards a low-fat diet, when you eat a low-fat diet, you end up eating a lot of carbohydrates and a lot of sugars.
Now, when we say sugar, are we talking about any sweetener like honey, maple syrup, molasses, high fructose corn syrup?
So there are going to be some differences in those. For example, when we were talking about those antioxidants, those flavonoids, you find those in some honey. All of those that you just mentioned, the sweet stuff, is going to be primarily made of sugar, of sucrose, fructose, and glucose. Those are the three main sugars you find in food. And it really depends on the form that you find them in. For example, table sugar and high fructose corn syrup, there's not a big difference between those. And the problem is the ubiquity. You find it in everything, and people are eating now 52 teaspoons of sugar every day. We eat about 150 pounds of sugar
per
person.
Can we escape it? In some cases, it's just part of the foods that we eat.
You can escape it very, very easily, and that's by switching to a diet of whole, minimally processed foods. That is really the key that we want Americans to switch from eating these processed foods, because the sugars get slipped in there.
So in your book, The Happiness Diet, which you wrote with Tyler Graham, you say that what the real problem is that much of our diet is high in refined carbohydrates, salt, and sugar.
Yes, I think what Tyler and I really wanted to focus on was the problem with processed foods, because foods that come in packages that are fortified with synthetic vitamins, and often if you look at the ingredient list, you're going to see a lot of different ways to say sugar, things like crystalline fructose and corn syrup solids and stuff that, not only is the sugar bad, but what really concerns me is you don't get these other nutrients and vitamins that we know the body and the brain need.
Now, the last time you were here was to talk about stress. Is there a connection between food and mood?
There's a significant connection between food and mood. We have a growing body of data that looks at the dietary pattern, looks at what people eat and their, for example, risk of getting depression. We have to remember that we focus a lot on obesity and diabetes and heart disease, but we really need to focus on mental health and brain health, because these are very disabling illnesses. And so you increase your risk of getting depressed by about 60% if you eat a bad diet. Adolescents, there's a good study looking at their dietary quality. The worse their diet, the more likely they are to get depressed and get attention deficit disorder.
And does it work the other way, eating whole grains and nuts and salmon and beets? Does that improve mental health?
Yes. This is one of those areas where we think so. There's good correlational data, but we need good clinical trials. It's interesting. There are no clinical trials currently on mental health and food, and it's something that we're really missing. There's a big piece of news recently this week about the Mediterranean diet reducing the risk of heart disease. And the exciting thing about that is it's a clinical trial. So we all inherently take correlations and we turn them into causation. And you really can't do that. That really is not true. So we need better clinical trials. Right now, all the data points to certainly eating a diet of whole foods and lots of omega-3s and lots of seafood is much better for your mental health. And I look forward to having better clinical data to back that up.
Well, the Mediterranean diet also, people claim it's better for us because the fat base is olive oil rather than butter.
Well, is
olive oil that much healthier for us than butter?
That's a good question. There's controversy about that. I don't think it's that simple. Olive oil is one of the major ingredients. The study of the Mediterranean diet had three groups. They had a control group that said, keep eating what you're eating, the standard modern diet, which is not particularly healthy. And then they had two other groups that ate the Mediterranean diet. One, they gave samples of olive oil to, and they actually tested urine to show that people were actually eating more olive oil. And the other was they gave samples of mixed nuts too. And nuts are something, by the way, it's a great example. Nuts are mainly fat, so people think fat's bad for them. They are by far the food that is most closely linked to increased longevity, decreased diabetes.
For some people, it also can be a problem if they have a colon problem. The nuts don't break up totally, and they can lead to some serious problems down the line, can't they?
Well, I've not heard much about that. I mean, perhaps something I haven't heard of, but I think in general, nuts are mainly fat. They're mainly monounsaturated fats. Plus, they have a lot of very interesting trace nutrients like manganese, which is very important for your health. And I think it's just something to note. Americans don't eat a lot of nuts, and they think about a handful of nuts as a very fatty snack, as opposed to, I think that is the perfect afternoon snack.
And then they think peanuts are nuts.
Yes, that's true. We're talking mainly, in my house we have raw almonds, cashews, and walnuts. Walnuts have a lot of those omega-3 fats, the shorter omega-3 fat, ALA, and it's a great thing if you're hungry in the afternoon to grab a handful of those.
Some listeners have been writing in. Jean in New Jersey asks, what's the difference between a low cholesterol diet versus a low fat diet?
This is a great question, Jean, because there is tremendous confusion. There are three different pools of cholesterol. There's dietary cholesterol. That is the stuff you eat in an egg yolk, and that has nothing to do with your health. And this really confuses people. The most recent meta-analysis took all the studies, and there haven't been many of them, that looked at dietary cholesterol and could not find a clear signal. And the reason is that your body is designed to make cholesterol. You make thousands of milligrams of cholesterol every day in your liver.
Well, there's good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. Well,
but that's in your blood, and that's where the confusion. When we're talking about cholesterol in your diet, it's going to come from meat or eggs or cheese. And you don't absorb most of this cholesterol, and it really does not have an effect on your health. Then the second pool is actual blood cholesterol. And when you're talking about good cholesterol, bad cholesterol, you're actually talking about the proteins that carry cholesterol around. And that's also an evolving science. For example, there are types of quote-unquote bad cholesterol, light, fluffy cholesterol, that aren't bad for you, that they don't seem to have the same inflammatory effect on the inside of the arteries.
So are you saying that egg yolks have been given a bad rap?
Yes, I am saying that for sure. Egg yolks have been given a bad rap. I think an egg is a perfectly healthy food. Most recent study just came out in January. They had people eat 3 eggs a day. Their cholesterol profiles improved.
But a lot of people only eat egg whites because
that's a horrible idea. All those nutrients are in the yolk. I mean, it's again where there's been a lot of confusion, and I think what you see is that people are really trying to do what's best for their health, and we need to do a better job of explaining what science we actually have and what science is not conclusive.
We're going to get to some more of the things that you've written about, but you've brought some kale here and some other things, and I'm assuming that you've been thinking a lot about kale because you're upcoming book is called 50 Shades of Kale.
Yes, I'm obsessed with kale. I've been eating kale every day in 2013, and the reason is that kale is, one, it's a great superfood, and two, it's so versatile.
So we're going to take a little break, and we'll come back, talk more about kale, take listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on a Facebook page, or you can also tweet us. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Stay with us for more of today's Please Explain with Dr. Drew Ramsey, who's an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Columbia University, co-author of The Happiness Diet, published by Rodale, and of the forthcoming book, 50 Shades of Kale, which will be published by Harper Wave in June. And we are back with Drew Ramsey, an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Columbia University, who specializes in the treatment of anxiety and mood disorders, and is co-author with Tyler Graham of The Happiness Diet, a nutritional prescription for a sharp brain, balanced mood, and lean, energized body. It is published by Rodale. Soon to be published, his second book called 50 Shades of Kale, which will be published by Harper Wave in June. And let's talk about kale. Now, during last summer, I joined a CSA, and kale seemed to come every week. And after a while, I had a lot more kale in my refrigerator than I knew what to do with.
Yes, you didn't know what to do with the kale. That is a common problem that I hear. I recommend kale and to patients all the time, and they tell me they don't know what to do with it. And that was the inspiration for 50 Shades of Kale. I partnered with a great chef, Jennifer Isolo, the skinny chef.
Well, can it just be substituted for lettuce? Because it's much tougher, isn't it?
It often can be substituted for lettuce in salads. You can saute it, but you can do all kinds of exciting things with it. We put it in chocolate chip cookies. We have 5 kale cocktails. You can use it in smoothies, and in juices is a great way. And I like to use it for bases of salad, but I think you want to mix up the type of salad. The one I'm making for you right now, Leonard, is my all-kale Caesar salad. And the reason is that those crunchy, somewhat thicker leaves, and that also, by the way, depends on the variety. There are literally dozens of varieties of kale. And so if people out there are thinking just of the green curly kale, I'd encourage you to try the other ones. There's Lacinato, Tuscan kale, which is a little bit more tender. I've brought red kale for you today.
Are there whiter shades of kale? Or is that just the
there,
bad
there side? Are. There's the Kamome white kale, which you'll actually see around New York City. If you're a forager, you can find all kinds of ornamental kales that actually are quite edible and delicious.
We have a lot of people calling in. Should we take some of these calls?
Sure.
Okay, we begin with Natalie from Manhattan. Hi, Natalie. You're on the air.
The connection, the neural pattern that makes a wall between you and the messages is when you focus on your hands. In other words, like you're saying, what makes me run?
You know, Natalie, you were not talking to us. You were talking to somebody else, and I'm going to go to another caller. Thank you so much anyway. Lauren from Harlem. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I'm someone who has a huge, earnest desire to provide good foods for my family. I listen to issues. I'm in the food business. I know about food, but I'm still stumped by the problem that it seems like some of the best foods, like blueberries, for instance, you're supposed to eat them as much as possible, but it's really, there's the problem of organic versus non-organic. So,
and beyond that, the fact that the blueberries that are available today are all being flown in from Chile.
Yep.
Right. So is it better to eat those because of their antioxidants or just to avoid them because of their pesticides and the fact that they're from so far away? What's a mom to do?
Lauren, it's a great question. I have a two-year-old who ate a plum this morning from Argentina, and I was thinking we'd get a question like this.
Still getting over it. Yeah.
Right. I think there are two questions you have. One is about organic versus non-organic, and there are some foods that we certainly want you to go organic, and a blueberry is a good example of that. What I would recommend if you want to eat blueberries throughout the year is when organic blueberries are in season and inexpensive that you buy them in bulk and freeze them. Because you can get a lot of blueberries for not a lot of money in the summer. Right now, they're tasteless. They come from Chile. They're very expensive. But it's the sort of thing, I don't like non-organic blueberries because I don't want to feed my kid neurotoxins. And pesticides are neurotoxins, and it's very clear that when we eat these things, they go through our bloodstream. And it's hard to prove that they're not good for us. But if I gave you an option of a food that had a neurotoxin in it and a food that didn't, I think everybody would pick the one that doesn't have it.
So what are you suggesting? We get the blueberries, we lay them out on a cookie sheet or something and put them in the freezer?
Yeah,
and then
you can actually just put them in a Ziploc bag, suck the air out of it, put it in the freezer.
Stick to each other and
They'll stick to each other a little bit, but then you pull them out, and during the winter, you can use them all kinds of things. You can put them in smoothies. You can defrost them and put them over yogurt, over ice cream. You can also then, I would say during the winter, look for other nutrient-dense foods that are in season. I think kale is a good example. Kale is available in organic form throughout the year because kale actually produces during the winter. And so kale actually gets sweeter after there's a frost. And for those of you who are out there who are farmers, my mom has been harvesting kale on our Indiana farm all winter long, and it's a little bit sweeter and delicious.
Let's take another call. This is from Linda in New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air. No, from Long Island.
Hi.
I'm sorry.
Hello?
Yes, hi, Linda.
Hi. I heard your comments about nuts. I am highly, highly allergic to nuts. The only nuts I can eat are peanuts and pistachios.
Well, peanuts are not nuts. They're
legumes.
Right. I know.
I heard your last part. I was wondering, is there any food that can substitute, for nuts that has the same nutrients and all the good stuff to eat?
That's
because I can't eat nuts.
Well, it sounds like you can eat some nuts, like you can eat pistachios.
Well, pistachios, that is about it.
And I would say that that's a healthy nut, and that's a nut you want to go with.
And aren't peanuts healthy because legumes are also healthy?
Yeah. I mean, they're a whole food. And so you're gonna consistently hear the message from me that eating whole foods is always going to be a better choice. There aren't really foods out there in nature that are bad for you. And so I would say that if you're allergic to other nuts, you certainly want to avoid those. What's healthy about a nut? That's a great question. One, I would say the fats, and you can get those monounsaturated fats in olive oil. The other thing is nuts have lots and lots of vitamin E. Vitamin E is an under-celebrated nutrient. About 90% of Americans don't eat vitamin E. And the reason it's so important is it dissolves in fat and protects fats. Other good sources of vitamin E are going to be avocados. You're going to get some in some other legumes and grains, rice bran, wheat germ, great sources of vitamin E. So you might want to augment your diet with those. The other things that are great that are in nuts, like almonds, are magnesium and folate, and you can get those in leafy greens.
What about garlic? Is that a superfood?
Yes, garlic is a superfood for a couple of reasons. One, again, a very low-calorie food. Two, makes food delicious and flavorful. So you put it on anything and it kind of tastes better. I just shaved some garlic into your all-kale Caesar salad. It has some interesting phytonutrients that are highly anti-inflammatory, one called allicin. And then it has a molecule called chromium. Chromium is very interesting. There are some clinical trials looking at a certain type of depression called atypical depression where people have a lot of low energy. And chromium has been seen to be somewhat helpful in those patients.
Now, I'm going to taste this kale salad, I hope.
I'm hoping you'll like it.
I'm sure I will. What about coffee and chocolate? They've often been controversial over the years.
Well, I brought you some cacao nibs that I want to pass over. Now, this is chocolate with no sugar. And actually, if you look into the data, there's not a lot of controversy. Coffee generally is found to be fights against diabetes and obesity. There really isn't a lot of data that says coffee is bad for you. And again, this is something we want people drinking, you know, a couple times a day at most. Same thing with dark chocolate. The studies on dark chocolate, and again, we're talking dark solid chocolate. The problem that people have is they will hear dark chocolate and they'll get candies and wafers and you know, things that have some dark chocolate on them. Dark chocolate has lots and lots of flavonoids, has a fair amount of iron, zinc. It's really quite a healthy food. It also improves blood flow to the brain in some trials. And so it's I think, an example of a great food from nature that is very good for you that should be eaten in moderation.
Well, these chocolate nibs are not awful to eat, but I wouldn't want to snack on them.
They're not, well, you know, they're a developed taste. I do snack on them. If you look at, so that's 100% cacao. And if you look at chocolates and dark chocolates, they're now rated, right,
for ranging you get
from 70% to 80%. So I would say, you know, you want to dial it in somewhere above 70% that you like it. The higher percentage of the cacao, the better.
And what's that other 30% in is 70%?
The other 30% is sugar.
Let's take a call from Bob from Rego Park. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Leonard, continue to do a great job. I have a two-part quick question. Dr. Esselin indicates that olive oil creates the environment for arterial sclerosis, and Dr. Campbell indicates that eating milk products creates an acid in the blood system that eats away your bones and creates a huge problem because Americans eat the most calcium anywhere else in the world. Where do you feel on those two issues?
So you're discussing the two big proponents of a vegan diet, Dr. Campbell and Dr. Esselin. And first, I want to say those two are leaders in the field of preventative medicine in helping us look to our diet as medicine. And that's very important. I don't agree with their findings for a couple of reasons. One, again, they're not based on controlled clinical trials. These are observational studies. Observational studies tell us a lot of things. And the other, they leave out some of the data. For example, the largest study looking at a vegan diet found that about half of vegans were B12 deficient. And B12 deficiency leads to having a shrunken brain. I think that the part that we don't have, and we should be honest that we just don't have the science to know, is if you add a lot of plants to your diet and you eat some very carefully selected meats. For example, I'd argue, what's wrong with an oyster? Or what's wrong with the mussel? Those are very nutrient-dense, delicious foods, lots of omega-3 fats in
B12. So shellfish, you think, are better kinds of meats. What about red meat? It's listed as a superfood, but
yeah,
most people think it's a terrible thing.
So let's talk about the type of beef that I recommend, because I'm one of the few physicians, I think, who will outright recommend that my patients eat some red meat. One, some means once a week, twice a week, and I recommend grass-fed beef for a couple of reasons. One, it has a much lower caloric content. I actually wrote this down, Leonard. One grass-fed strip steak, an 8-ounce steak. You want to guess how many calories? Only 250 calories. And with that 250 calories, you only get 2 grams of saturated fat. And I don't think people should be so concerned about saturated fat, but most people are. When you compare that to a grain-fed steak, you almost have twice as many calories.
Well, if you eat it in combination with something, doesn't that also make both things a little healthier?
Well, what you're, I think, thinking about is that when we eat forms of iron, heme iron is found in meat, and you actually have a whole separate system in your intestine for absorbing heme iron. When you eat heme iron with non-heme iron, like the iron that we'll find in this kale, you absorb both a little bit better. And so there is a synergy. But I think the caller's question is there is a movement out there to say don't eat any meat, don't eat any fat, and that's good for your arteries. And I would really ask you to look carefully at that data because it's very, very thin.
We're running out of time, so I really want to taste some of that salad. But while I'm eating it, what about rice, beans? A listener asked about sunflower and pumpkin seeds versus nuts.
All right.
Do they all have dietary value?
Well, let's take the first. Rice, polished rice or white rice, is how we began to discover vitamin deficiencies, because you take out all the vitamins. So in our home, we have wild rice, we have black rice, brown rice. I think that those in moderation, you know, can be very healthy. They're a great source of vitamin E. The other things like sunflower seeds, again, they're a seed, they're a nut, they're a whole food. They can be very healthy for you as a good snack.
What about vitamin supplements?
I'm against
that. Forgive me, I'm chewing.
That's okay. I hope you're enjoying it.
Well, you cheated. You made a wonderful salad dressing.
Well, of course. That's part of kale is delicious, but a Caesar dressing, it makes everything delicious. The question about vitamin supplements, I'm against vitamin supplements unless you're medically ill, because for a healthy person, the most recent study of healthy women found that vitamin supplements actually increase the risk of death.
And fish oils?
Fish
those
oils,
pills,
again, I'd rather have you eat fish. Calcium is one of those things. I'd rather have you eat yogurt and sardines. But if you are under the treatment of a physician and he's advised you take a supplement, I think you should listen to that advice. But, you know, we should listen to Hippocrates, right? He said, let thy food be thy medicine and thy medicine be thy food. And that's really what we want people to have be the foundation of their health.
We couldn't get to all of the calls or the questions, unfortunately, but you answer many of them in your book, so maybe people want to check out The Happiness Diet, co-authored with Tyler Graham and published by Rodale. And also the new one, the forthcoming one, is called 50 Shades of Kale. It'll come out in June from Harper Wave. My great thanks to Dr. Drew Ramsey, who is an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Columbia University, for joining us once again to talk about healthy foods on today's Please Explain. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Leonard.
On tomorrow's show, the Wall Street Journal's Supreme Court correspondent Jess Braven and government prosecutor Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Crouch talk about the courts at Guantanamo Bay, where suspected al-Qaeda terrorists are tried. And then Rita Moreno looks back at her career on stage and screen. She's one of the few artists to win an Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony Award. We will also look at the underground network of phone freaks who managed to hack into the country's telephone system, plus the political and moral dilemmas posed by the technological efficiencies of the digital age. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Tim Einenkel and Rachel Neal were at the audio controls. And we had help today from Christy Yamasaki and Lindsay Hodges. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.